From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And with the benefit of aerial shots, receding waters, and sunshine, we can see the extent of the damage from Irma in Florida, especially in the southernmost Keys. FEMA Administrator Brock Long said this morning that a quarter of the homes in these island chains have been destroyed.
This is going to be a frustrating event. It's going to take some time to allow people back into their homes, particularly in the Florida Keys. If you look at what happened in Florida, obviously Monroe County took the brunt of the hit, and a majority of the homes there have been impacted in some ways, with several of them destroyed and many more with major damage.
So that's the Keys. Let's go a little further north. NPR's Kirk Siegler is at a gas station in Miami. And Kirk, this is like that proverb, telling what it's like in Florida depends on which part of the elephant that you're touching. What's it like there in Miami?
Right, Robin, like all around me, I can slowly see signs of like normalcy returning. There's a decently long line for the gas station. It's open. Right now I'm watching some utility crew workers taking a break, and they're walking into a restaurant, a cafeteria across from me that's open. The McDonald's is open. And in fact, the line at the gas station, most people are telling me they're only waiting about 5 minutes. So that's the situation right here. And the airport has reopened, at least in a limited capacity, just a couple minutes ago before we started talking. There was the roar of a jet, American Airlines jet, above us. So some signs of some normalcy coming back here, but a long way to go.
Right. And we look in the way north part of the state, the Sheriff Department in Jacksonville saying all bridges into downtown Jacksonville have reopened. They had that record flooding yesterday, but many roads still flooded. There's even flooding up in Charleston, South Carolina. But let's look south to the Keys. The pictures of some of the damage on some of the middle Keys, terrible. What are you hearing?
Well, just that. And the fact is, we still don't know the full extent of the damage, and we may not for a number of days. We know that, as you said, at least 25% of the homes there are total losses. I have a colleague who managed to squeeze into one of our producers managed to squeeze into a Coast Guard flight and got a look at all the devastation firsthand and said, you know, there are boats that have been blown up onto streets. Some have sunk, lots of roof damages, gas stations, like mangled mobile home parks, totally destroyed. So it's going to be a long time there. And it's still, you know, you have to consider it's still an active search and rescue operation, too.
Yeah.
People are still trying to get in, people are hoping to get in, and some people are still very much in need of food and water.
Yeah. Stephanie Copley runs the Florida Keys Outreach Coalition for the Homeless. And she reminds us that many people, this is a tourist economy, and many people work in the industry at restaurants and resorts, and they work paycheck to paycheck. On the other hand, there's always, you know, maybe an economic boom for, you know, people who have carpenter skills after something like this. So what's the sense of what this is going to do there?
I think it's too early to tell. There are still people who are just getting back in, and in fact, some people who did evacuate aren't going to get back into their places lower, much farther into the Keys or farther out in the islands for some time. Marathon Island apparently has some of the worst reported damage.
Right.
But all around me right here, I can definitely see construction crews out. In fact, the city of Miami, city officials today said they've never seen a cleanup of this magnitude. They've never faced something this big, clearing all of the debris and all of the downed trees. And in fact, the big story here and in the Keys, for that matter, is the fact that there's still no power in many, many places. And we're being told, residents are being told, they're going to have to wait at least another several days. You can hear a plane flying over me right now.
I'll tell you, it's a great sound, great sound. Up to 15 million people we hear in Florida without any power, and yet there we hear planes taking off. Just real quick, we just have a few seconds here, Kirk. The police there, where you are in Miami, said they've arrested dozens of suspected looters. Is there still a curfew in effect? What's the sense there?
There is a curfew in effect, we're told, from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. for that reason and just general safety reasons for the concerns of looting. I've been talking to a number of evacuees who, just like in a lot of natural disasters, are worried about the possibility of that because no one's watching their homes and the possibility of break-ins. But there have been a number of arrests so far for that. Of course, it's always hard to tell if it's people breaking in need of essential items, so we don't want to speculate too much. But there's this curfew still in effect.
Yeah.
for the foreseeable future, and certainly things aren't getting back to normal anytime soon.
NPR's Kirk Siegler in Miami. Great to hear planes instead of wind. Kirk, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Hillary Clinton has returned to the spotlight with her new book, What Happened? Clinton spoke with Morning Edition today, and joining us now is Here Now political analyst Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hello, Jeremy. Happy to be here.
Well, great to have you. And let's listen to what Hillary Clinton said when Morning Edition host Rachel Martin asked her if this book relitigates the past and maybe doesn't help the Democratic Party move forward. Here's what she said.
Well, they don't have to buy my book. And they can turn off the radio when they hear me talking. I'm not going anywhere. I have the experience. I have the insight. I have the scars that I think, give me not only the right, but the responsibility to speak out.
So as a Democrat, Angela, are you happy to see Hillary Clinton return to the spotlight?
I don't think Hillary Clinton ever left the spotlight. I think that she's made quite a dent in electoral politics on a presidential level. She's been around for decades, right? And I don't think, to her point, that she is going anywhere. Hate it or love it.
But does she help the Democrats by coming back with this big book tour and talking about the 2016 election and what she thinks went wrong?
Well, so, and I think here's a real challenging piece. Like, we can pretend like we didn't just have, you know, the battle royale, both in the primary and in the general election in 2016. But even if we bury our hands in the sand, in quicksand, right, like, it's still a struggle that we very much have to deal with. I've been approached by folks in the Democratic Party and super PACs about leaning into Democratic politics and advising and putting my name on things. And I'm not ready to do that. So there is a huge divide. I know that I'm not someone, Jeremy, that you expect to kind of bite their tongue, and I'm not going to start doing it now. There are a lot of problems. I think, you know, the Democrats' response to Charlottesville was weak and lukewarm. I think there are a number of spaces that we have a lot of work to do, and I think the main leaders have been Democrats in Congress. But when you get outside of that and you turn your attention to what's going to happen in 2020, I think you have a lot of different interests, and they're not all on one page right now. And the only way to really get there is to ensure that folks can have honest, unfiltered, and raw conversations. And maybe her book will be the opening to that.
Well, in her book, she blames sexism. She blames media coverage of her. She says that husbands and fathers told women not to vote for the girl. Do you think that that's fair? And do you think that she's taking enough responsibility for the loss?
Well, I definitely think Hillary Clinton has some owning to do, right? Whether we're talking about when she talked about wiping it with the cloth or something about the emails or some of her other kind of sarcasm that didn't really land. But there also is a ton of sexism in electoral politics. I think we can see that by the sheer number or lack thereof of members of Congress, both on the Senate and the House side. I think we can see it nationwide. And I came to the conclusion pretty early on, both in the primary and when you started to see the surge of evangelicals who said they would vote for Donald Trump. It was very clear to me. I grew up in the church. I grew up in the Church of God in Christ, kind of 16 to 25. And Jeremy, women were told they couldn't lead congregations, that they weren't the heads of households. So if you're not the head of a household, you can't be the head of a congregation. You certainly can't be the commander in chief. And so sexism does have a role to play in this. Does that mean that Hillary Clinton was the perfect candidate? No. But compared to Donald Trump, she was Michael or Michelle, the archangel. So we have to remember who she was up against. And when I think you remember who she was up against and what she was up against, it's clear sexism had a lot to do with it.
Well, one of the people that she was up against that she talks about in this book is Bernie Sanders. And she said that Sanders hurt her during the primary. Do you think that's fair? Because I remember at the time, some of the analysis was this is going to make her a stronger candidate going into the fall because she's got a real fight in the Democratic Party.
I think that's right. I think I was one of those folks that thought that he was going to strengthen her. I don't know that I would say that Bernie Sanders hurt her. It may have made her more vulnerable, but I think that those vulnerabilities would have been exposed one way or the other.
Do you think she's planning to run again?
No. I don't. I think she made it clear from what we've seen of the book, which is not much. By the way, people are going nuts about this, and we don't know so much about what's in this book. But I think she's making it very clear that those are not her intentions anymore.
Which Democrats do you think could run against Trump in 2020 and win at the moment?
Oh, man, I think that's really tough. There's been a lot of chatter about the only two Black Democratic senators we have, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. There's been a lot of chatter about Elizabeth Warren. There's been a lot of chatter about Joe Biden, who seems like he really is ramping up. And I got to be honest with you, I love all of those folks. And I think they're all very, very strong. So I'm just looking forward to a really good race. And I'm looking forward to a fierce one. Again, I think that the Democrats still have a lot of identity and soul searching to do. And I think that it's healthy for us to do this in the public so people can align with, you know, Democratic politics to the extent they feel it represents them. It's supposed to be the big tent. It's not always easy in a big tent.
That's Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist and Here and Now political analyst. Angela, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The Avett Brothers have been charming fans with folk rock ballads like this one for more than a decade.
There's a darkness upon me that's flooded in light. In the fine print they tell me what's wrong and what's right. And it comes in black and it comes in white, and I'm frightened by those who don't see it.
And now their star is rising even higher. A new feature-length film by Judd Apatow and Michael Bonfiglio called May It Last is in theaters nationwide today for just one night ahead of an HBO release next year. The movie follows Scott and Seth Avett as they record their Grammy-nominated 2016 album, True Sadness. Along the way, there was a marital breakup. Here Now's Peter O'Dowd met up with Seth and Scott before a recent show and talked about the film, their relationship, and the emotional energy it took to create their latest album.
It's about 3 hours to showtime at Tanglewood in western Massachusetts, and the Avett Brothers are feeling relaxed, mostly.
I get a little nervous, but more for my physical health than like, you know, hitting the wrong chord or something. I'm always afraid that I'm going to get way, way into it like I do most nights, and that I'm just going to hear something pop, and that's just going to be it.
It can be hard to tell the brothers' speaking voices apart, but this is Seth. He's the one with hair past his shoulders and creaky knees that doctors blame on years of stomping around on stage.
Well, you know, we're just getting old, Peter. You know, we're getting old.
How old are you, like 35, 36?
I am 71 years old.
So he's good-looking 71.
Seth is actually 37. He's 4 years younger than Scott. Scott plays the banjo and sings. Scott is described as the outgoing brother, the one who is always on. And right there you could sort of hear the camaraderie between them. The Avetts grew up on a small farm in North Carolina. Their grandfather was a pastor. He died many years ago, but Seth says his sermons still inspire the themes of familial love that are common in their music.
He seemed to have a pretty good hold on love of humanity and on the complications of having a life and the blessings and the demons that come along with the human condition. That's you're touching on the nucleus of the entire thing, it seems like, you know, for the film and for the band. Is that we have this very fortunate dynamic of having Scott and I and our brotherhood as the nucleus of the project.
The legendary producer Rick Rubin says that relationship is unique in music. Rubin helped bring fame to bands like Run DMC and the Beastie Boys, and now he's taken the Avett Brothers under his wing. In the film, he explains what makes them different.
If you look at the history of bands with siblings, whether it be the Bee Gees, the Kinks, the Everly Brothers, any ones that we can think of that tend to hate each other. I think the Avetts are the rare example of a family-based band where there's love and understanding and appreciation for what the other brings.
If you're looking for truth, I'm proof, you'll find it then.
And you do like yours.
I asked Scott how they pull that off.
We take care of ourselves. We don't drink as we did as younger men in the beginning.
Because that could cause conflict.
It caused it constantly. We have conflict, but we don't hate each other. We love each other very much. And we were told early on by our father that you're going to get out there no matter what you do, and your brother and your sister and your neighbor, these are your advocates. They're going to take care of you, and you're going to need them, and they're going to be people that don't have that same loving feeling towards whoever, and that might be you, and take care of each other. You know, that resonated with us anyway.
And, you know, the whole thing about the stereotype about brothers or family members not getting along, it just so happens, like, the darker stuff often is either more interesting or more sensationalized. But, like, I'm sure there's plenty of bands with brothers in them where they get along fine. You never hear about Malcolm and Angus Young fighting. You never hear about Eddie and Alex Van Halen fighting. Like, the ones where, like, an Oasis where they're just tearing each other down in public, that's a bit more interesting.
Is there a song that you have that is about being brothers?
It's certainly in Murder in the City.
I wonder which brother is better, which one our parents loved most. I sure did get in lots of trouble, they seemed to let the other go. A tear fell from my father's eyes. I wondered what my dad would say. He said, I love you and I'm proud of you both in so many different ways.
Some may be turned off by the sweetness of the Avett Brothers lyrics, but for others, the writing is the very thing that pulls them in. And the film pulls back the curtain on their creative process. In this scene, Scott and Seth are alone with guitars and a notebook.
Wish I was a sweater wrapped around your hips.
Sounding out the chords and the lyrics to the song, I Wish I Was.
I think we maybe need another verse that's maybe not an analogy verse.
Another approach could be going through and saying, I don't wish I was a candle. I don't wish I was a sweater. I don't wish I was a song. I am this, and this is where I need to be.
I'm not a song. I'm not a sweater. Something better.
Seth says capturing that moment was gold. It's a window into the making of an album that was born not out of familial harmony, but out of conflict. Much of True Sadness is an elegy to Seth's first marriage and a reflection on his divorce that spilled into the gossip columns with whispers of infidelity.
There wasn't anything easy about it. You know, every day it was like there was a new very sharp sort of pain that went along with it. But yeah, the public side of it and what some folks would say about it was hurtful. But luckily for me, I kept a pretty good distance from that, you know, as well as I could anyway.
Well, I'm gonna wash the dishes, pay the bills, and watch the news.
And considering that pain, some fans have asked why his song Divorce Separation Blues sounds so upbeat.
Well, I'm not sure exactly why I did it that way. Sometimes there is just a small fraction of mystery that comes along with some of these ideas. When it kind of first hit me, I was driving up a gravel road up in Swannanoa in the mountains of North Carolina, and snow was everywhere, and I was listening to a lot of Doc at the time, a lot of Doc Watson at the time, and I was just listening to a lot of his yodels. The form of the yodel was just, I mean, I was just feeling it so much, and divorce was the only thing I was thinking about. You know, that completely consumed me, so that's a way to get things out.
Excellent work, everybody. Excellent.
Cool. Really good.
One of the final scenes in the film explores the darkness in this album.
Yeah. Oh.
Seconds after Seth and Scott finish recording one of the most moving songs on the album, No Hard Feelings.
A little burned out.
Okay, take a few minutes.
Yeah.
Well done, man. Producer Rick Rubin is ecstatic with the performance. Seth is visibly drained, and Scott, he's kind of angry that Seth is getting applauded for writing a song that took such an emotional toll on his brother.
The elephant in the room is that the song sells, and that I can't get away from that feeling for myself. I can't get away. It's not just that song, it's every single song. And that it's congratulated upon achieving, and I'm deeply conflicted about it.
When I asked Scott about this moment, he said he was ashamed to watch it.
Because I see in the movie how I'm raining on Seth's parade in a way, because there is a relief. And the whole room should be lifted up because we just successfully solidified an expression that we were chasing, you know? And we did it. We got to it. And Seth and I have talked before about when a song is written and recorded, you can look at it two ways, like it just died or it just came to life. There was a dying feeling for me in that.
And Seth says he was angry with Scott because he told me, what if someone had done that to Whitney Houston when she had just finished recording I Will Always Love You? And Seth says he doesn't think the song died in the studio. It gets stronger every time he plays it. Kept me afraid and cold, with so much to have and hold, under the curtain.
I do have a weird feeling when that song starts and we're rolling into it. I feel like I can be there, present with it or not. I just feel like God is just sort of just guiding me along, you know, just feeding me the lyrics.
For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
The film May It Last by Judd Apatow and Michael Bonfiglio about the Avett brothers is in theaters today across the country, one day only. It's Here and Now.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
And we want to check in now in New York, which is holding statewide primary elections today. National attention is on New York City, where incumbent Mayor Bill de Blasio, a rising star in the Democratic Party when he first took office, is facing four other Democrats today, looking for a second chance to lead the country's largest city, and maybe looking beyond that to a national stage. Bridget Bergen is City Hall reporter for WNYC. Bridget, remind us about de Blasio, his mixed marriage to the dynamic black poet Shirlane McCrae. They're teenagers. His son's proud Afro. You know, he captivated people.
Absolutely, Robin. When he was elected 4 years ago, you know, he emerged from this really crowded field of candidates, including probably the most known nationally, Congressman Anthony Weiner. When de Blasio won that primary, that really vaulted him into the general election. And, you know, he essentially crushed his competitor, Joe Loda, in the general election and entered office with what I think he and many of his supporters would argue was a real mandate. And with that mandate, they have tried to implement new policies, some, you know, have been hugely successful. I think the one that everyone points to is universal pre-kindergarten, mm-hmm. and that is available to four-year-olds across the city. But he has also attempted to play a more national role, and that has had less success. Notably, the city vied for the Democratic National Convention to host it in 2016 and lost that bid to Philadelphia. And probably more stark, the mayor himself formed an organization called the Progressive Agenda. And that was a group of progressive lawmakers and supporters that wanted to try and influence the presidential election in 2016. And the goal there was to have a forum in Iowa where they could influence the candidates and really make sure that income inequality was part of the presidential campaign conversation. That movement really kind of imploded, and they had to pull the plug on that forum before it ever even got off the ground.
Yeah.
And so, and he has, as has been covered widely here in New York, a very contentious relationship with our other leading Democrat, Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Okay. Well, the mayor also pledged to end stop and frisk and improve police-community relations, but there have been protests against police, and some of the police unions are blaming him for not supporting them. So we have only about a minute here. The winner of today's Democratic primary will face the Republican Nicole Malliotakis and an independent Bo Dietl in November. Is there a sense that de Blasio maybe has this wrapped up but then still has work to do to win back some of his supporters? What's your sense?
Absolutely. I think there is a strong sense of confidence that de Blasio will likely be reelected in November. He's trying to position Nicole Malliotakis as the Trump candidate, and President Trump did very badly here in New York City. However, there are folks across the city who want more from the administration. To his left, there are people who want him to be more progressive on some of those reforms that you cited. And folks who are more in the middle and to the right see some of the changes that he has made to the police department and other places as, you know, making the city less, lowering the quality of life in ways because they have decriminalized certain low-level offenses. Mm-hmm. So public urination and being in parks after dark, things that they think should have stricter enforcement.
Well, Bridget Bergen, City Hall reporter for WNYC. New Yorkers will go to the polls today and make their feelings known in this primary. And we'll check back in November, see how it works out. Bridget, thank you.
Thank you.
Major airports in Florida are open again today following Hurricane Irma. Florida's largest airport, Miami International, resumed limited operations this morning. At least some flights are also running out of Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, and Tampa. Southwest Florida International Airport in Fort Myers is still closed. There is a lot of logistical work that goes into shutting down an airport and opening it back up. And joining us to talk about that is Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy, albeit under very difficult circumstances.
Absolutely. For people across Florida. And let's talk about one of the first things that has to be done, which is, I guess, to get the planes out of there for the storm and then to bring them back. How difficult is that? Did they take all those planes out of Florida for the storm?
They did. American Airlines, for example, the largest airline in Florida with a giant hub at Miami International, got almost every plane out of Florida. They told me this morning there were two planes left in the panhandle when the storm hit. That, of course, at that point, still far away from the storm. And then those two went away. So they got those planes out of harm's way. They took them generally to other hubs. And that's because those are places where they have large crew bases where, you know, once the storm passed, as it indeed has now done in Florida, they had lots of people to staff the planes, bring them back to places like Miami and other cities they serve and gradually restart the operation, which, as you said, is what's happening today.
So yesterday we heard about American Airlines and other air carriers flying in crew. So are they just flying them in to Miami, let's say, on empty planes?
Yeah, American, for example, flew a giant 777, you know, usually a plane you'd see flying to Europe or South America, perhaps, from Dallas to Miami, a 757 from Chicago O'Hare, bringing in supplies and people. Don't forget, American, in its case, has 10,000 employees who live in Florida. These are people who, in their own lives, many of them without power, some of them with damage to their homes. You know, they've got to worry about their families. And so the airline actually asked for volunteers from elsewhere in the country and said they got more response than they even needed. People willing to go down to Florida and sort of relieve some of those people while they dealt with their own issues unrelated to their jobs at American.
Another concern I know is that they had to check to see that the jet fuel that they store at Miami International Airport hadn't been destroyed or tainted by water that might have gone in there.
Yeah, and that's part of getting things going again. And part of it, you just sort of picture it. There's this preparation for the storm at an airport. So a place like Miami where, they're bringing in those baggage handling equipment and what they call FOD, foreign object debris, you know, anything that can become a projectile during the storm. They lower the light pole masts. And so then after the storm, they reverse all of that, put all that in place. And yeah, they've got to inspect everything, as you said, down to the jet fuel. The FAA has to come in and do its own inspection and sort of, you know, recertify the airport, say this place is safe again for commercial flights.
How long does it take for them to get back up to normal?
to normal, it takes a while. I couldn't get anybody at an airline today to confidently tell me, when they think the system will truly be running normally. But if you take a look, for example, at the waivers that are out there, taking Americans, for example, they're right now through September 17th. That's Sunday. Gives you an idea if they're telling people, hey, you can change your plans flexibly until then, that they're hoping that by sometime around then things will be more or less normal. But I think here in the next day or so, they'll be running schedules that'll somewhat resemble normalcy, albeit at reduced levels, which the one lucky thing about this from their perspective and from the perspective of travelers, this is low season. This is not a holiday weekend. And so you can reduce the schedule somewhat and still more or less be able to take care of people when
they
travel.
Well, you say this is low season. Just in the 30 seconds or so that we have left here, high season for the Caribbean, a lot of these islands were really badly damaged, is coming right up. I wonder how much it's going to hurt the airlines that there's been so much damage in the Caribbean.
It's going to hurt the islands more than the airlines. I mean, look, this is going to cost the airlines hundreds of millions of dollars, what's happening this week. Demand in terms of, somebody who wants to go to a beach, look, they can't go to St. Martin now. Right. But those same airlines that serve St. Martin are probably going to carry those customers. They're just going to go somewhere else. So the longer-term damage is to tourism in those places.
That's Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly. Seth, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Gas is returning to the pumps in Florida. Let's take a look at the EPA's plans for the gasoline supply, the Environmental Protection Agency's plan to reduce the amount of low-carbon fuel. Now, this is fuel that's made from plants. It produces less carbon dioxide than petroleum or even ethanol, which is made from corn. And this proposal has some people concerned that the Trump administration's plans to pull back from supporting innovation in renewable fuels. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media has more.
On a sweltering summer morning, Rob Mitchell takes me to visit a plot of switchgrass at a research field near Lincoln, Nebraska.
So it's almost, 6 feet tall in spots.
Yep, and it'll get a couple feet taller than this. So we're putting on a lot of biomass right now.
Mitchell is an agronomist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he says biomass is what this grass is all about. It's called Liberty Switchgrass, and it was developed here specifically to grow thick and lush. The grass can then be harvested, and all the cellulose fiber can be broken down to make what's called cellulosic ethanol. Mitchell says right now, almost all of the ethanol we burn in our cars is made from corn.
But that second generation, going to something that has potentially more application on marginally productive cropland, where maybe corn and soybeans aren't best suited for the long term, switchgrass or the other native perennials fit very well.
Switchgrass grows well in fields that have poor soil where farmers may lose money planting corn, and it has environmental benefits. Switchgrass roots grow deep. They pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it in the soil. From field to tailpipe, cellulosic ethanol has a smaller carbon footprint than fuel made from corn. Sounds like a win-win, but
it's just really hard to do at any large scale.
Scott Irwin is an economist with the University of Illinois. Switchgrass may be ready for the field, but Irwin says until the science improves, converting it to ethanol is not cost-effective.
Especially when you're competing against corn-based ethanol, which is, a very well-developed technology, and we can obviously do it pretty cheaply.
Even so, the federal government requires certain types of renewable fuel to be mixed in the nation's fuel supply. Cellulosic ethanol is featured in that policy because it's so carbon friendly.
We all know about the Obama administration's support for the Paris Accords and climate change and so on. Clearly, the Trump administration's going in the other direction. So it's not surprising to me that we see a small cutback.
The Environmental Protection Agency wants to cut back on the amount of cellulosic ethanol oil refiners have to blend into the fuel supply. Right now, the fuel in that category mostly comes from biogas, from sources like landfills, not switchgrass. The EPA says it's still leaving room for growth, but the agency is responding to the market. Cellulosic ethanol is expensive, and the industry has lagged behind production targets. Janet McCabe says that was true when she worked at the EPA under the Obama administration. But the agency still made a point of increasing the amount of cellulosic ethanol each year, even if by small amounts.
For us, that was a very important signal to maintain in the rule. That's what Congress had said, and this doesn't do that.
The Trump EPA would cut 73 million gallons from the 311 million gallons under the cellulosic category in this year's renewable fuels mandate. And in the years ahead, the administration will likely have the chance to reset biofuel policy more broadly. Supporters of cellulosic ethanol are concerned the administration could give up on low-carbon fuels made from stuff like switchgrass. If federal policy does not carve out a space for cellulosic ethanol, McCabe says the oil industry and corn ethanol producers are unlikely to make room for it.
You have stakeholders who they just can't accommodate one another. The more you have of fuel X, the less you have to have of fuel Y.
Just think how coal has been displaced by natural gas to make electricity. But without a guaranteed share of the fuel supply, investors will be hard-pressed to put their money into cellulosic technology. And Rob Mitchell in Nebraska says that means farmers will have little reason to plant switchgrass.
Farmers are very adaptable. If you give them an opportunity to make money and give them realistic goals, they can meet those very quickly.
For now, switchgrass remains on the sidelines as the Trump administration begins to put its mark on the future of renewable energy. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Gerlach in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Grant's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a collaboration focusing on rural issues.
Apple is set to unveil a series of new iPhones today, including a premium model called the iPhone X. It will commemorate the 10th anniversary of the original iPhone, which, as we now know, has changed the way many people interact with technology and the world. Today's event will be the first in Apple's Steve Jobs Theater at its new campus in Cupertino, California. And joining us now with a preview is Ben Johnson, who covers technology for us now at Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So put this in context for us. This is an event that happens every year, but it gets a lot of hype. Some people think too much hype. How important is this in Silicon Valley?
Well, I mean, Apple can sneeze and Silicon Valley will jump up and applaud, right? We have to acknowledge that, Jeremy. But it is a big deal. This is one of the most valuable companies in the world that makes one of the most coveted products in the world. And every hardware event Apple does has an impact on consumers, investors, developers, and it has an impact on the markets as well. So maybe not always a cause for applause, but yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah, I was reading this morning that we wouldn't have Uber without the iPhone. And think about all of the other things that have come from that device. So what about the iPhone X, which I guess we're going to get a look at today?
It's expected to be expensive, Jeremy.
$1,000.
$1,000 or more, price tag. So you'll think it's amazing and jump into the store and buy it. But look, you've got this iPhone X, as it's being called, expected to have an OLED screen, inductive charging so you don't have to plug it in, a bigger edge-to-edge screen that might get rid of the home button.
What does that mean, inductive charging so you don't have to plug it in? How do they charge it?
So you would, like, if you're in Starbucks, for instance, and you see these little pads on the table, you can actually put your phone on the pad, and through inductive charging, it'll charge. And that's really interesting because Apple can set the standard in this area. Inductive charging has been around for a long time, but Apple basically, if Apple comes out and says our three new phones that we're making have inductive charging, they can really set the standard for this sort of thing. And, you know, it's still a luxury device by a lot of measures, but then again, I just bought a phone from Google, the Pixel phone, and the cost of that, it's the old version. There's supposed to be a new one any day now. The old version of that is approaching $900. So the price tag is not that unusual.
Well, and this is not going to be the only iPhone that we're going to hear about and see today. What kind of changes can we expect for the existing 7 and 7S?
Right. So we're going to see updates here. Again, expected. This is all rumored. What we're calling the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus. There'll be upgraded versions, probably with glass instead of aluminum bodies, more similar to earlier iPhones. And this would actually allow for this inductive charging that we're talking about. And again, what's interesting about that is sort of it can set the standard and actually spur a bunch of companies that have products around inductive charging to make those products, make even more of those products, which I think is interesting.
And then they can all sue each other to say, I had that idea first.
That's right.
what other things are we expecting today? Because, the iPhone is now a very important part of Apple's business, but it's not the only part.
Absolutely. So we'll probably get a new operating system, iOS 11, possibly a new Mac. New Apple Watch is expected with LTE connectivity. A lot of people are talking about that. You remember the HomePod announcement maybe from earlier this year. We might get more information on Apple's late entry into the smart speaker market. Another kind of late entrance for Apple is 4K Apple TV. Higher definition television support has been around for a lot of other video streaming devices, Roku, Google's Chromecast for a long time. I'm really curious to see if Apple is going to do more with augmented reality, and which can be defined as everything from that computer-generated first down line you see on the football field while watching TV to Pokemon Go, this app where you bring your phone up and see the real world, but there are animations overlaid into it. So I'm going to be looking for that augmented reality news if it comes.
Now, this event from Apple starts in about 3.5 minutes. People may wonder, how does he know what they're going to say? And I guess the reason is leaks.
Yeah, and this is the kind of new normal. Tech coverage has evolved and changed just like Apple has over the last 10 years since the iPhone was announced. It's been harder and harder to keep things secret at the company. There's also some, I think, purposeful leaking that goes on, right, where companies like Apple, Google, Microsoft, they're all trying to help feed the hype and really telegraph where they're going, not just for consumers and developers who make software, but also investors. This year, though, there was what some people are calling a kind of unprecedented leak where two sites, 9to5 Mac and Mac Rumors, got what is called the Golden Master, which is essentially a bunch of detailed information about what is going to be announced at the event. And the new thing here is that some people watching the leaks think they came from a disgruntled employee at Apple itself, not somebody from a manufacturing plant or something like that. And that's a little bit unusual.
And a disgruntled employee?
Yeah.
But they haven't figured out who it is.
As far as I know, at this moment, not yet. Or at least, you know, we haven't figured out who it is.
That's Here Now is Ben Johnson, who covers technology for us, talking with us about Apple's big event, which is going to be starting in just a couple of minutes. And we will find out, Robin, what the new iPhone looks like and how much people are going to have to fork over for it.
And I can't imagine there's just one disgruntled employee in each company like that.
What did Apple do wrong to them? That's what I want to know. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.